From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It was 25 years ago this year that we saw the release of Do the Right Thing. It was also 25 years ago this year that Huey P. Newton was murdered. And my guest sitting across from me is a man who I first met in 2001, seeing him do a Huey P. Newton story on stage at the L.A. Theater Center. He's now starring in his one-man show, Frederick Douglass Now, at the Bootleg Theater here in Los Angeles, Roger Guinevere-Smith. Roger, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Elvis.
You know, you've done so many of these one-man pieces, Juan and John and Huey P. Newton story, and just recently, in the last month, I saw you do Rodney King and now Frederick Douglass Now. What is it about these moments of rage that you like to play out on stage? Because it's really fascinating to see, having seen all of these pieces.
Well, rage, I think, is part of how I grew up. My youth was defined, I think, by the rage of 1965 Los Angeles riots, which is part of the Juan and John story, Juan being Juan Marichal, the Hall of Fame pitcher for the San Francisco Giants. John Roseboro is John, the great catcher, the late catcher of the Los Angeles Dodgers. Marichal hit Roseboro upside the head with his baseball bat, and I witnessed that on television soon after witnessing Western Avenue going up in fire and smoke, where my family had a business, and my father and I stood in front of the business to make sure that folks knew that it was a black-owned business. And I was so traumatized by what Marichal had done to Roseboro with his bat, Roseboro being a hero of mine, that I took Juan Marichal's baseball card and I tore it up and I burned it and I chanted, "Burn, baby, burn, burn, baby, burn." That's part of the motivation of my work, but certainly the greater part, I think, of my work is motivated by love.
But I mean, I just sing the Frederick Douglass Now, which I just saw you do over the weekend. I was struck by the number of times you used the quote from which he's most famous, without struggle, there is no progress. And that becomes, in the different ways you voice it, it becomes about where he was at each point in his life when he said it, doesn't it?
Well, I think that it was an essential definition of who Douglass was. Douglass came under the wing of the abolitionist establishment. He made a fantastic speech in Nantucket under the auspices of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society.
It was the Canandaigua speech.
He doesn't remember anything about that speech, but he was obviously very impressive. And the abolitionists wanted to kind of trot him out as an example of the enslaved intellect. And Douglass wanted to be more than that. He wanted to publish his own paper. He wanted to speak up and say what he felt like saying, and to make himself known on issues that the abolitionist establishment necessarily didn't want to address. And so this is really the first motivation of him saying, if there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are those who want crops without plowing up the ground, etc. He said
who want rain without thunder and lightning.
They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. Struggle may be a moral one, it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. And you can fast forward that to the final scene in Do the Right Thing, where the character Smiley, whom I play, places the picture of Malcolm X shaking hands with Martin Luther King on the pizza parlor wall that he has just incinerated, because lo and behold, an NYPD officer put a character by the name of Radio Raheem into a chokehold and murdered him. That was 25 years ago. It was a movie, but we fast forward 25 years and it looks kind of like a rerun, doesn't it, Elvis?
But it's also, too, Roger, that moment you're talking about, and that photograph of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X is a moment about forgiveness and joining and finding a way past anger. And I just think about so many things you've done. I mean, first of all, I'm guessing one of the reasons you end up doing the Huey P. Newton story is that you've probably been told your entire life how much you look like Huey Newton.
Well, that's the easy part. Yeah, sure.
But then, too, that must have stimulated something when you're hearing that constantly and growing up where you did and when you did. And those questions about Huey, who as a figure seemed to transform himself every 5 years and try to find something in the wrong that he had done to move himself forward. I mean, that sort of schism or that joining of struggle and progress.
Absolutely. And oddly enough, it was August 22nd that Huey lost his life.
It 25 years ago.
Also August 22nd that Marshall hit Roseboro upside the head with a baseball bat. So I don't know what it is about that particular date. But yes, of course, Huey's struggle was with the society, of course, but it was also with himself. And he had vices that were very much self-acknowledged. And Rodney King's vices were self-acknowledged. And oddly enough, these two men, Rodney King and Huey Newton, came to the public attention because of their conflict with the police department, the Oakland Police Department, of course, in the case of Huey Newton, the LAPD with Rodney King. They both died under extraordinarily tragic circumstances at the age of 47. They were both first-generation Californians.
It's a treatment. I'm speaking with a gifted Roger Guinevere Smith. His play, his one-man show, Frederick Douglass Now, is now at the Bootleg Theater in Los Angeles. Through when? When's the last date, Roger?
The 24th of August. So, of course, we'll be playing there on the 22nd of August. Bootlegtheater.org. That's theater, the American spelling. Thank you very much. E-R.
But here's the thing, though. I just find so much in watching you doing these one-man shows. I mean, I asked you this when I did a Q&A on stage with you at Rodney King. There's a poetic feeling to it, to all these things. They all feel like these kind of word tapestries, like poems. I find myself thinking so much about the last poets when I see you work, and that way that I'd rather they work, that, you know, those things didn't exist as text, as script, but rather as feeling. And that's important to you, isn't it?
Well, feeling, improvisation, all that good stuff is certainly important. I collaborate quite frequently with the very gifted Mark Anthony Thompson, a.k.a. Chocolate Genius. We've done many, many productions together. Mark Anthony sometimes is on stage with me, but more often than not is off stage. And in fact, for Rodney King, design an extraordinary soundscape without even being in the same room with me. We communicated across country with each other, and he didn't actually have an opportunity to see it until I performed it in New York City in January of this year. So that's, you know, how technology is now working for us in a way that it certainly couldn't have worked for us 20 years ago when we initiated our collaboration with a piece called Christopher Columbus 1992. In which Columbus is still among us as a lounge entertainer with political aspirations who runs a travel agency on the side.
But this idea of audio and visual collage, when did that first come to you? Because it's definitely a way to really transform stage into an experience that feels as much like film as it does like theater.
I think that I have certainly literary influences and certainly cinematic influences, but I think that my great influence, Elvis, is AM radio, KGFJ.
Really?
KRLA, KHJ, all of the great AM stations, you know, that I listened to growing up here in Los Angeles. The great DJs, Magnificent Monique, Lucky Pierre, Wolf Mad Jack, all of those voices in the night, as it were, that were quite influential, I think, on my performance technique.
What was the first play you recall seeing? What was that?
Oh, I know exactly what it was. I walked into my house when I was maybe 6 or 7 years old, and my parents were arguing, and my uncle Milton Wood was there. He had taught Belafonte and Portier at the American Negro Theater in Harlem, USA, and was a best friend of my father. They had gone to college together. And I was very upset that the three of them were there and that my parents were arguing. And my Uncle Milton took me aside and said, "Roger, listen, your parents are simply rehearsing what is called a play." And I said, "A play?" He said, "Yes, a play. It's a play called Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?"
Wow. And what was, you just remember feeling more than hearing anything, don't you?
I remember the visceral idea of my parents being in a vehement argument and the embarrassment, I suppose, of my uncle being there as well. And the feeling of that, of being exposed to that. And after my Uncle Milton revealed to me what a play was, that was the first notion of drama being able to affect emotion for me.
Does it also have to do with something, the reason that you do so many one-man pieces is because you want that same sense of intimacy that you had in being in that room with your parents?
Well, I think it's intimacy. I think it's also a kind of logical and very economic way of traveling. You know, with Rodney King, for example, all I need is a mic and maybe a nice little white carpet to play on. With Frederick Douglass, it's nice if I have an American flag or maybe two or maybe three. That's cool, too. With Huey, it was just a chair and a mic. These are economic ways of working, but I think that they're also influenced again by the AM DJ. They're influenced by my father's record collection, his blue collection that I discovered and memorized, of course.
Red
Fox.
Oh my gosh.
Wild Man Steve Gallen, Richard Pryor. These were the great monologues of my youth and the tradition in which I aspire to work.
But also, I feel that this is something interesting, and you tend to do it as an actor on film, too, is you have a way of just speaking directly to the audience. And there's a kind of connection that you're drawn to making as an actor, really speaking to people and doing a one-man show, economics aside, really gives you a way to do that.
Absolutely. It's direct address. It's spiritual. It's also the person on the street corner. You know, after I created the role of Smiley for Do the Right Thing, people asked me where that character came from. And I didn't realize until some months down the line that they were actually influenced by people that I had known. There was one gentleman who stood on the corner of what was Santa Barbara Avenue, now Martin Luther King Boulevard, and Western Avenue on that corner. And he sold the Los Angeles Sentinel, the black paper. And my father patronized him every Thursday night. And he said, "Thank you," the best way that he possibly could. And there was another guy who had been a great athlete at my high school, but he was hit by a truck. And he became the locker room attendant. And he talked like that, too. But he had a fantastic memory for all kinds of athletic details. He could tell you what end zone, what year, what the score was. And he, I think, was quite influential as well. So I tell my students, you know, the greatest tool of the actor is observation, and you never know when you're going to be seeing something or hearing something or feeling something that is going to be of use to you at some point down the line. So keep your eyes and your ears open.
Keep your ears open. Here we're talking to Roger Ginn-Vera-Smith. His new piece at the Bootleg Theater here in L.A. is Frederick Douglass. Now it's a treatment on KCRW. We'll take a break. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. We're getting into trouble with Roger Ginn-Vera-Smith. His new one-man piece, his newest, is Frederick Douglass. Now it's at the Bootleg Theater here in Los Angeles. I guess, though, as we're talking, and that's what I really get from you, is voices. And in each of these pieces you've done, there's a different voice, not only a different voice, but a different way of breathing. You can sort of hear how constricted Huey's voice is and the way it sort of seems to catch in his upper body.
Well, if you smoked as many cool cigarettes as Huey did,
you would be constricted too.
But I'm aware of that. And with Rodney King, there's a really kind of heavy sense of breathing. I mean, you're trying to convey that weight, not only the physical weight, but also that metaphorical weight that he's carrying. I'm just really struck by that physical sort of location of voice that you do in each of these pieces.
Oh, thanks for listening, because only a keen listener would be able to make that note and to ask that question. I think that each character that I play, yes, has a different placement. The voice doesn't come from the head. It comes from the gut. And the breathing apparatus is something that is supported by the total body, particularly the center of the body. And that's where each of these voices has to be found.
And also, too, I mean, we know about Douglas that he was such a great orator that when he was in the U.K., that there were SRO crowds, people that
was... He was a rock star.
And a spellbinder. And there's talk about rooms being filled to the point of suffocation when he spoke there. And I just wondered, too, for each of these, when you first speak the lines, as you're working out these characters, for example, in the case of Frederick Douglass, at what point did that sort of sense of using the voice as power and having an understanding of the power of the voice, which separates him from all the other characters that you played, when did that come to you?
I think it comes to me on a nightly basis, if I'm lucky. It's a constant search for truth, Elvis, because I could roll through these speeches by rote, but Douglas was a man, and he reveals to us in that classic, beautiful letter composed to his former master on the 10th anniversary of his escape, his self-liberation from slavery. He reveals his connection to the institution of slavery, not necessarily philosophically or ethically, but rather through the experience of being separated from his sisters and his brother, with whom he could never communicate, because they had been deprived of the power to read and write. He had taught himself how to read and write, but they had not learned, and there was no opportunity for him to communicate with them. This was the great conundrum. This was the great tragedy for Douglas, and he connects us with that, I think, in a very primal sense in that letter.
It's true. We're talking about Frederick Douglass and many other people that he's played with, the actor, writer, director, Roger Gunver Smith. His new show is Frederick Douglass Now at the Bootleg. I guess as we're talking about this, you're talking about Douglass and his awareness of the power of words. And you were reminding me, you talked about Harriet Tubman, how when his first autobiography was published, people didn't believe that a black man could have written it.
Well, that's why he had to write it. Because he was such a dynamic, articulate speaker that people had doubted that he had ever been a slave. So he had to write a narrative revealing places and persons that he had known as a slave. And of course, that immediately put him in jeopardy, because there was this thing called the Fugitive Slave Act. And even though he was living a nice life in Massachusetts, he could be captured and re-enslaved. So he had to actually go abroad. That's the first time that he went, and raise enough money so that he could actually purchase himself back from his master and return home ostensibly a free man. And he also raised money for his own printing press. And he came back and he immediately went to work and published his own newspaper entitled The North Star.
Well, I just find this fascinating, that language and the power of language and the power of language in specific terms, each of these lines that you're playing out is something that's really attractive to you.
I think it has to be.
Why do you say it has to be? It has to be for you,
obviously.
It
has to be because my parents had a library in our home, and that library included Frederick Douglass's narrative, and I read it for the first time as a child. I'm sure I didn't understand all the words and all the images, but obviously it stayed with me for some time. And my mom also had a two-volume set edited by J.A. Rogers called The World's Great Men of Color. And there I was exposed to biographical sketches of men throughout history, some of whom were not regarded as African men. Alexander Pushkin, for example, the greatest literary mind of Russia, was an African man.
Or Dumas.
Both of them.
I guess, though, so. the way language is a power, and the way you use the character's confidence or diffidence about language and about words becomes part of the way you play these characters, too.
I started rehearsing Frederick Douglass, listening to Paul Robeson simultaneously. And I don't think that my father was ever more proud of me when he walked into my room and I was reciting Douglass and listening to Paul Robeson. Because usually he'd walk in and I'd be listening to Richard Pryor or Hendrix. So, you know, this is something that is important in terms of the legacy, in terms of the grasp of this fundamental thing, which is called language. Always something that was important in my home, even if it was, as I said, my father's Red Fox collection.
Well, he was a great talker, too. It's the treatment. I'm talking to another great talker, Roger Gunver Smith. His new piece at the Bootleg Theater is Frederick Douglass Now. When I saw the show, your daughter was there. But she's, again, getting back to these sort of primal forces that you play out on stage. I mean, what is it like for a kid to see her dad going through all these things? I just wonder what your conversations with her about that have been like, and what facets of you she's getting to see on stage she doesn't get to see anyplace else.
Well, I talk about this actually in my Juan and John play. And there was a moment where my daughter and I had the opportunity to go out to dinner with the widow of Spalding Gray, Kathy Russo, and their two sons. And we talked a lot, you know, about Spalding, of course. And
Spalding, another gifted monologuist who used, but his pieces were explicitly autobiographical, whereas
yeah.
yours are autobiographical, that we get to see your own feelings about these forces that you're playing out in these one-man shows.
Well, after the dinner, my daughter said, you know, Dad, I don't think I really know anything about you unless I see it on stage.
What was it like to hear?
It was kind of damning, but it seemed to work within the context of the dinner that we had just had. I, for some reason, had chosen to share with Spalding's family this experience that I had had in Jamaica, where I was trying to make a film about a suicidal poet and almost wound up drowning, which is probably a story they didn't want to hear, you know, considering their father jumped off the Staten Island ferry in December and was found in March in the East River. But I think that my daughter, in her brilliant way, has found a certain liberation through her art to be able to not only explore the world, but explore the self.
Tell me more, though, before we go, about this piece about the suicidal poet that you were trying to do, the film you were trying to make.
Well, I was doing a film, improvising a film, actually, called Who Killed Bob Marley? And
who has also been a touchstone on every piece that you've done. That name has come up every single time.
Of course, my patron saint. So I played a suicidal poet who goes to the Calabash Literary Festival, which is a wonderful, great literary festival on the south coast of Jamaica and Treasure Beach. And he goes there to present his work and then to jump off of a cliff. Why? Because he feels that he's betrayed his generation, the spirit of 79, as it were. And he says in his poem, Who Killed Bob Marley? It was I, it was I, it was I who infiltrated I and I. So we had a shot where I'm standing up on top of a cliff called Lover's Leap on the south coast, where, as legend has it, two slaves who were in love, a man and a woman, were to be sold and separated. They join hands and they jump off the cliff and disappear. So we have a shot of me up on the top of this cliff wearing a blue fedora, which is a hat that I had made for my father for his 80th birthday. And then we had one last shot, and it was to be the hat simply floating in the Caribbean. Simple shot, right? So it's just myself and my brilliant cinematographer, A.J. Arthur Jaffa, who, of course, shot Daughters of the Dust. And it's he and I on this little stretch of beach, and the hat was uncooperative, my late father's hat. And it sank, and we didn't have the wherewithal to say, oh, maybe we should just put a piece of styrofoam in it or a soccer ball or something. So I go out, I put the hat on, submerge myself to get the shot like that. So, in so doing, and, you know, it's 7 o'clock in the morning, I get washed out in a riptide and jammed up against a rock, and 200 sea urchin needles go into my right foot. And I'm trying desperately to fight off the toxins and to hold on to my father's hat and to tread water. And I had to let go of my father's hat, which was traumatic in and of itself. And then I had to kind of wave to AJ as if to say, hey, man, I'm not acting anymore. This is not a scene. He left the camera running, looked up and down the beach, and miraculously there was a little surfboard there. He went out on the surfboard, paddled very calmly. I said, oh, damn, he's from Mississippi. I didn't know he knew how to surf. And he gets to me. I look at him. He looks at me. And he says to me, you know I can't swim. So he had put his life on the line to come out there and save mine. And then up above us on a bluff, there's some Jamaican children pointing at us, and a Jamaican man comes out very stout in full regalia, snorkels, fins, etc., and comes out to us. He's kind of like Lloyd Bridges meets Marcus Garvey. And then the three of us make our way to shore, and AJ revealed to me that his father had been a lifeguard, but he had never learned how to swim.
There could be a movie in that, and we're out of time, and I'm so sorry, and I'm glad to finally have you here after all this time, Roger. Thank you so much for doing this.
And thank you, AJ, for going out there on that surfboard.
Yes. Thank you, AJ. Thank everybody, all these people who've influenced you and kept you alive. My guest is Roger Gunfer-Smith. His new work, One Man Piece at the Bootleg Theater, is Frederick Douglass Now. Recording engineer who also mixes the show is Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Hold on to your hats.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.